Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Steve continues vacation, so we will continue best of week here. Sean Carey got more great interviews lined up for you. And how about a crazy play-by-play call of the day last night? The Dodgers getting three in the top of the ninth to take the lead over the Phillies. And then what do the Fightins do? They get three of their own in the bottom half of the ninth, including a walk-off by number three.
And the first pitch to him. He swings and drives it to center. It's falling. It's a base hit. It kicks away from Pollock. It goes to the wall. The game is tied. Around third is Kingery. The Phillies will win it. The Phillies have come back, and they have won the ball game. Bryce Harper has turned into the hero. 9-8 Phillies win. Wow.
Last night here on News Radio 1070 WKOK with Scott Fransky, 9-8 the Phillies getting the win, and Bryce Harper's first walk-off as a Philadelphia Philly. Is this the turning point of the season? Just when you think they couldn't have hit rock bottom, you thought of it. Monday night's game was bad enough. Then last night when they lose the 6-1 lead, oh man, how could it be worse than Monday night? Well, it felt that way for a while. Hector Neris then getting tossed and Gabe Kapler getting tossed in the ninth inning. And by the way, there is some Phillies news to share with you. Nick Williams has been called up from Lehigh Valley. And Jay Bruce, who had to leave the game last night due to a oblique injury because of Jay Bruce on the injured list. You now have Nick Williams getting the call up from Lehigh Valley. He has been on a hot tear in the minors the last couple of weeks. So we got more great best of interviews to share with you here on WKOK and the Steve Jones Show. Last fall, we had a chance to get in touch with New York Times bestselling author Jeff Perlman. He discussed his book about the USFL, Football for a Buck, the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL.
I found this book to be absolutely fascinating. Jeff Perlman, New York Times best-selling author. The book is Football for a Buck, the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL. And Jeff, as a courtesy to you, we did not have you watch an 8-minute video before you came on the show.
About how great your tell is.
That's right.
Before coming on this program, you must sit through an 8-minute episode explaining why this show is so fantastic.
Exactly. That's what I do. See, you can tell I read the book.
Yeah,
I figured that out.
Or either that, or you visited Trump Tower in the 1980s, one or the other.
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah. You and I may have inadvertently sat through that 8-minute video at some point in the 80s in Trump Tower.
Yeah.
We'll get to the president and former general's owner in a moment. I found this book fascinating, and I want to go back. The impetus for us was Mr. Haight telling you there's more to this story. So now, in this lifetime, what did you discover in the more to the story that when you wrote your first paper years ago and got that disappointing B+, that you know you just never knew before that told you how crazy this league was?
Well, I didn't know any of it. I knew very little. I was, you know, I wrote it. It was Mr. Haight. It was Eric Haight. And it was Naopak High School. My senior thesis was a 40-page paper on the USFL, which I got to think he didn't read. There's no way he read 40 pages. Like, 2 weeks left till summer. Some snot-nosed 18-year-old hands in a 40-page paper on the USFL. I think you're skimming that thing at most. I don't know. I was like I was a kid of the 80s. I loved the USFL. I loved the Generals. I think the thing for me was I was always fascinated by upstarts and the merging of worlds. So like guys like Herschel Walker coming to a new league and Steve Young and Jim Kelly, these guys, you know, youth college stars coming to a new league. And then the league dying and those guys going to the NFL. So I knew very, very base. My knowledge of the USFL was good for a kid growing up in Maropac, New York, but until I wrote this book, I didn't know nearly. When people ask me that question, like, what did you learn? I always feel like saying, the book is, whatever, 350 pages, 349 pages are pretty much what I learned that I didn't know.
Right. What's interesting is I always have felt that the original concept of the USFL, regional, you know, the Philadelphia Stars were associated with Penn State and so forth, I thought was a brilliant idea that I thought could have lasted had they gone through with it. Now, John Bassett was obviously a big believer in this model. Tell us a little bit about John Bassett, because, you know, he tried the World Football League, and, he's actually one of the few people Donald Trump would listen to.
John Bassett, the owner of the Bandits, is sort of the hero. You know, it's interesting. I've had some discussions with people about turning the USFL into, you know, into a film or a TV show, and they say, Donald Trump is probably the villain. Who's the hero? And I really think the hero is John Bassett. He's the owner of the Bandits. He had a world, as you said, World League team in Memphis. He believed in the idea of spring football, slow growth, one or two stars per team, and then you're going to kind of fill out the roster with regional guys. And he was the best. And the best thing I found this entire book, my money find, was a letter he wrote to Donald Trump on August 16th, 1984, on Tampa Bay Bandits letterhead. He was the owner of the Bandits. Trump was the owner of the Generals. And included my favorite paragraph of all time, which is, "You're bigger, younger, and stronger than I, which means I'll have no regrets whatsoever punching you right in the mouth the next time an incident occurs where you personally scorn me or anyone else who doesn't happen to salute and dance to your tune." He just saw Trump for what he considered him to be, which was a con man. And he would tell anyone who would listen, "This guy is a con man. I can't believe we're listening to him." And this is going to sound like a political statement, and maybe it is. I think had John Bassett lived, he would be, I don't even know, beyond shocked that the same, because a lot of the same tactics Trump used with the USFL, he really did use in running for the presidency. I don't even think that's a political statement, because if you read about the USFL, you see a very similar playbook.
What's interesting, too, is that you talk about getting the one or two stars. Obviously, Herschel Walker, there was not a rule in place in 1980. You had to have, in order to be a guy that could go to the NFL early, you had to graduate. Todd Blackledge did, Mike Munchak did from Penn State. Yet Herschel Walker leaves after his third year at Georgia. The irony is, if you're a Penn State fan, there is contact with the USFL before the Sugar Bowl, just like there was contact with Mike Rozier before he played the year after. And by the way, J. Walter Duncan was the owner of the Generals originally, the Oklahoma oil man. How did that process play? How did they get Herschel Walker? Because the NFL wasn't going to touch him. How did they possibly get him to go over?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. So, like you said, the NFL wasn't taking underclassmen back then. So you had to play your 4 years of college. And Herschel Walker, after his third year, you know, he's from Wrightsville, Georgia. He's from a very poor family. He won the Heisman Trophy winner as a junior. He won a national championship. He was, I always say for younger fans, it's almost hard to picture nowadays, he was an iconic national football player. You know, wouldn't you agree? Like, Herschel Walker wasn't just Cam Newton comes along or, you know, Jay Bartlett. Like, he was a different level. He was a sort of a holy deity of football at the time.
I'll give you one that will help you on that, that will help the fans. I did the pregame show with Joe Paterno before the Sugar Bowl, and I asked him about Herschel Walker, and the guy he compared him to was Jim Brown.
Right. And the guy people are comparing Bo Jackson to is Herschel Walker. Like, it's that sort of, those guys were that sort of rare air kind of football players. And he didn't want to go back to college. He wanted to help his family eat. And the NFL wouldn't touch him. So he had a sort of representative, quote-unquote, named Jack Manton, who reached out to the USFL on his behalf, called the offices and said, you know, Herschel wants to come out. And, I mean, there's a lot of back and forth. We really debated it for a long time. Do we want to do this? Do we want to break this sort of rule about underclassmen? Will the colleges even allow our scouts on campus if we do this? And ultimately, they decided to go for it. And the funny thing is, as soon as the USFL got serious about Herschel Walker, the Dallas Cowboys reached out to him. and said, if you want to come to the NFL, we can figure out a way to sign you early. And he said, no, I already gave my word to the Generals. And the USFL gave him a choice of where he wanted to play. He could pick any team. He could pick New York, New Jersey. And it was a really, it was the first real sort of terrifying moment for the NFL. And there were many terrifying moments in relation to the USFL.
And no question about that. Yeah, the Generals aren't really great in that first season, and the USFL gets through that first season, but they get an infusion of new ownership. We mentioned Donald Trump buying the New Jersey Generals. And we all, because, I mean, Duncan gets sick of flying back and forth from Oklahoma. And Bill Oldenburg taking over in Los Angeles. Now they're going to go about the business of trying to sign one of the genuinely nicest people on the planet in Steve Young with a pros pro who's not an idiot in any way, shape, or form in Lee Steinberg. And Oldenburg treats them like garbage and he still signs.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So, you know, Young was coming out. He was going to be the number one pick in the NFL draft in 1984. And the Cincinnati Bengals had the number one pick. And he did not want to go to Cincinnati. Number one, the weather. Number two, the franchise. Number three, Ken Anderson was their quarterback, and he was really good. So he just didn't want to go there. And the USFL comes along, and they tell the USFL fixed their draft up and down. It was all fixed. Like, the number one pick that year was Mike Rozier from Nebraska. And the Maulers were given the number one pick after everyone said they won the lottery, but the truth was USFL fixed it because they said they could sign him. Steve Young would have been the number one pick. He was the number one player on anyone's draft board, and he actually went 10th in the draft to the LA Express. And basically he said they reached out to him and said, if you could play anywhere, where would it be? And he said, well, I'd play in LA. So they made him LA's property, and the team was owned by this guy, Bill Oldenburg, who's absolutely, he's an SNL guy, absolutely crazy, wasn't financially sort of stable, at least not as much as he thought he was. And they offered Steve Young this crazy, crazy, it was a $40 million deal, but it was really an annuity. So it was $40 million over a bunch of different years. It was kind of a different kind of deal. And they go to negotiate the deal at Oldenburg. They go to finalize the deal at Oldenburg's office in San Francisco. And it's Oldenburg's birthday. And he's this little guy, and he drinks a lot, and he's getting drunker and drunker. And Lee Steinberg and Steve Young are downstairs negotiating with Oldenburg's people, and it's taking a long time. And he keeps coming down the steps or down the elevator. What the hell is going on here? Why is this taking so long? Well, Mr. Oldenburg, it takes a while. An hour later, what the hell is going on? Why is this getting drunker and drunker? Finally, he buzzes down and he says, get Steve Young and Lee Steinberg up here now. And he's completely wasted, and he's just waiting. He wanted to be done so he can go out with his friends for his birthday. There are all these glass jars atop a bar in his office. He smashes them all. He's in the penthouse. He takes a chair and he's about to throw it out the penthouse window. He's jabbing Steve Young in the chest, saying, F you, F the Mormon church, blah, blah, blah. And finally, at 2 in the morning, he kicks Steve Young and Lee Steinberg out of the office. He says, I should have never dealt with you guys. You guys are frauds. And Lee Steinberg and Steve Young, the most powerful agent in sports, and, you know, the highest, soon-to-be highest-paid player in pro football, are standing on the street at 2 a.m. in San Francisco. And the next day, sober and somewhat humbled Bill Oldenburg calls and apologizes. And Steve Young consults with a bunch of people and decides he should still take the money, and he does.
One thing crazy. That it would be, you know, history is a great teacher of any lesson. The USFL took the immediate cash and went from 12 to 18 teams. So they took the immediate expansion cash, which is a nice infusion. But what did that do to dilute the league?
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, they didn't do very good background checks on some of their owners. So they did a few things that were really stupid. Number one, like, they went to Tulsa. Tulsa's the best example. The Oklahoma Outlaws, who had great helmets, great uniforms, Doug Williams as their quarterback. The USFL sometimes just did the worst background checks ever. The Tulsa franchise was going to be in San Diego. And at the last minute, the stadium authority in San Diego would not let them play at what later became Qualcomm Stadium. So they decided to go to Tulsa. And the University of Tulsa had reported that their football team had averaged 30,000 fans per game the year before. So the ownership group thought, all right, we'll go to Tulsa. And it turns out they were just lying. Like, they literally just made that number up. They averaged about 17,000. So the Outlaws come there, and they're expecting these huge crowds because they didn't do any research into their research, and they can't draw anyone. They moved to San Antonio. They play in a converted high school stadium called the Alamo Stadium. The owner is this guy, Clinton Mangus, this complete fraud oil and gas guy. It's the Gunslingers are the greatest franchise of all time. Their general manager was a Korean War vet whose only prior management experience was running a feed store. Their coach had last coached Texas A&I 8 years earlier. He was in early onset dementia, and he only had seven fingers because three of them were lost in a lawnmower accident. And he coached from the stands next to his wife because he thought he had a better view. The management, they signed their star was Rick Neuheiser, the quarterback from UCLA.
Yep.
And early on, before games started, they had one of the guys asked Rick, "What do you think we should do? How should we provide the visiting teams their uniforms for the games?" Like, they actually didn't understand that teams come with their own uniforms. It was my favorite. I think my favorite is they didn't. They were super, super cheap, and their field was basically a thin layer of turf over cement. And they used industrial spray paint to spray their field instead of sort of skin friendly. So players would slide on this field, and they would get these huge skin burns. But the paint would rub off into the burns. So the burns were bad enough as is, but there'd be paint infecting the burns. And the team was so cheap, they would never clean the field. So one guy was telling me, like, it's 100 degrees in San Antonio in the spring. People are getting these infections. Everyone's getting, like, pustules and big scabs. And because they were so cheap, they never cleaned the field. So it was just a walking cesspool of hell. Those are the Gunslingers.
In fact, Rick was here about 15 months ago here in State College. And for whatever reason, during the conversation, the USFL came up, and he said, when we got checks, it was a race to the bank to see which ones would get cashed and which ones would bounce.
Well, let me tell you, my favorite player in that whole league is this guy, Greg Fields.
Oh,
he was
my goodness.
Defensive lineman out of Grambling.
the one that tried to kill John Hadle.
Yeah, so he was caught by the LA Express. John Hadle was the head coach. He punched John Hadle in the face, and the team hired Liberace's bodyguard away from Liberace to protect John Hadle. And then, only because the USFL is the USFL, and this stuff would only happen there, even though this is well known that he punched his coach, it's literally in the news, the Gunslingers need defensive line help. So they sign Greg Fields. Then they stop paying Greg Fields. And one day he follows the owner home in his Buick, and he has a baseball bat in his trunk. And this guy, Greg Fields, is about 6'6", 280. Little Clint Mangus gets out of his car. There's Greg Fields holding a baseball bat. And he says, "I see where you live. I know you have money. I think you should pay me." And Clint Mangus goes inside and comes back out with a paper bag filled with $70,000 in cash. And says, "Are we good?" And Greg Fields is never seen again.
Oh, all right. It was no secret that Donald Trump, no matter what he would say to the face of the other owners, what he wanted was an NFL team, and he wanted to go to Shea Stadium, have a stadium built in Manhattan, probably have it named after him, and then be in the NFL. Yep. I mean, he pretty much made no secret of that to people around him. I mean, is that essentially how this story goes, where it just takes them down the hole they can't go down?
It's very interesting, actually. This has been the weirdest. The simultaneous having a book come out about the USFL while Donald Trump is running for president, and people say, "God, you're so biased against Trump." And I always say this, and I really mean this. You could take Sean Hannity, you could take Chris Matthews, give them a year and a half to research the USFL and see how they feel about Trump as a president, because everything he did. So he buys a team after the first USFL season, and all he does in the lead-up is praise how great the USFL is. "I love spring football. It's just wonderful." As soon as he gets a team, "We need to move to fall. We need to take on the NFL directly." And he actually does something that I really think passes prologue. He arranges a meeting with Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner, at the Pierre Hotel in New York City. Trump pays for the suite. And he says to Rozelle during this meeting, "I don't give a crap about the USFL. I want an NFL team. What do I have to do to get in the NFL?" He's basically offering to throw the USFL under the bus in order to get an NFL team. And Rozelle knows his Trump's reputation. He knows Trump a little. And he says, "As long as I'm the commissioner of this league, as long as my heirs are affiliated with the NFL, they'll have nothing to ever do with it." And I say, and I really believe this 100%, when you see Donald Trump lashing out at the NFL, when you see him, you know, complaining about the kneeling and blah, blah, blah. This is a guy who tried buying the Colts in the early 80s and failed. He tried meeting with Pete Rozelle and failed. He tried suing the NFL and failed. He tried buying the Buffalo Bills and failed. And he tried buying the New England Patriots and failed. It's just a lifetime of setbacks and shortcomings and rejections with the NFL that started really with the USNL.
I mentioned earlier that history is the greatest teacher. The USFL had, I mean, look, this is the league that had Reggie White, had Jim Kelly. Of course, how Jim Kelly got the Houston's another story. But, I mean, you know, Herschel Walker. I mean, look, they had, and they had some good football. And not only that, what Houston and the Express had a playoff game that, you know, is one of the greatest games, like people, very few people didn't see. I watched it. It was awesome. One of the best playoff games I've ever seen. But in the end, what are some lessons out of this league that is a lesson for anybody who wants to get into sports?
I mean, it's a basic life lesson, which is you got to walk before you can run. And they had this nice thing going. You know, they knew they were going to lose money early on. Like, that was all part of it. But it was very repeatedly stated, you're going to lose money early on. We're starting a sports league. Give it patience. Give it time. And, you know, John Bassett early on was asked during one of the owner meetings. He said, you were in the World League. What was the, what's the key to survival? He took a drag of his cigarette and he said, every week six teams are going to win and six teams are going to lose. And what he was trying to say is ultimately it's just football, and it's take its time and let it develop and let it cultivate itself. And they just rushed it and got panicky and followed Donald Trump's lead. And they wanted to take the NFL on directly, which was suicide. I do think it was a great idea. I think if they had given him more time and they just exercised patience, I don't know if it'd still be around, but it would have been around a lot longer.
I mean, look, because Tampa Bay was fun with Steve Spurrier. I guess Denver, the first year, actually made a little bit of money, although he's an extremely cheap, cheap owner.
That's why he made money. Jacksonville did great. Memphis did great. I mean, if you think about it, if you really think about it, the NFL player strike happened in 1987. And I really think if the USFL just held out till then, you would have had this sort of football anarchy. And I think the NFL probably would have wanted to nip it in the bud. Jacksonville was drawing 40,000 a game in the USFL without having a particularly good team. Memphis drew well. Baltimore was, after the Colts left, the Baltimore Stars were the best team in football. Oakland with the Invaders had a really good thing going. Birmingham, a really interesting market. I just think four or five of those teams, maybe six, would have wound up in the NFL.
I agree with you. Look, to be honest with you, this is an interview that could go on probably for 2 hours because I have still another 90 minutes worth of questions or at least fun stories about the league. I mean, seriously, that's how much I enjoyed the book, you know, the Cliff Stout part and things like that. Because Jack Ham was asking me, Jack's my broadcast partner for Penn State football.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, by the way, Jack, you're in the book. He goes, I am. Because Bandisac mentioned him. And and Cliff Stout's name came up. And, of course, Cliff Stout goes back to Pittsburgh and has a day to forget. But after doing nothing in Pittsburgh,
you know what's funny? One thing that's funny about that. So Cliff Stout, he was the Steelers quarterback when Bradshaw was hurt. And I guess 82, I think. 82 or 83. 82. Or maybe 83. Anyway, and he has the audacity of signing with the USFL. He hated in Pittsburgh. Like, why wouldn't he sign with the USFL? But Pittsburgh fans are just really sort of bothered that he decides to sign with the USFL. And the Birmingham Stallions come to play the Pittsburgh Maulers, and it's a snowy, freezing day in Pittsburgh. And the fans in Three Rivers just spend the entire afternoon throwing ice chunks at Cliff Stout's head. That's basically what it is.
It's amazing. But they were a fun league. They were, every established league, this will be the final question because I know I've got to let you go. Every established league gets something from a league that was an upstart. You know, and you see it today in the three-point shot in the NBA. You see certain elements of the WHA with the European influence in the NHL and so forth. What did the NFL get from the USFL?
Man, ton of things. Number one, a ton of good players, almost 200 players. Four Hall of Famers, Steve Young, Jim Kelly, Reggie White, Gary Zimmerman. The run-and-shoot offense, which the Houston Gamblers or Jim Kelly, they were running. They went right to Detroit when the USFL folded. The two-point conversion, the coach's challenge. fun end zone celebrations, wide receivers wearing uniform numbers 1 through 19. I mean, on and on and on and on. And the biggest one that players don't realize, and it's unfortunate, is if you look at the salary scale in professional football, it just skyrockets between 1983 and 85. That's when players, again, whenever Le'Veon Bell signs with Pittsburgh, whatever he makes, he should at least tip his hat toward the USFL, because the reason money exploded in pro football was the USFL's presence.
Jeff, it was awesome. And like I said, I could go two more hours, really. I really could. But I appreciate the time that you gave us today, because I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I hope you did as well.
Yeah, thanks for reading the book. That means a lot to me. It really does.
Oh, it does. This is Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. I already have a color analyst I work with that's going to borrow it, okay, because his name's in it.
Nice.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks,
I'm
Jeff.
Fred,
right, Jeff, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah,
wow, that was fun. That was fun. I really had a great time with that. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Steve is taking his annual siesta on the Cape. He'll be back Monday, so we're in best of mode. Checking out some of the great interviews we've had in the past on the show from the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. And Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip routes 11 and 15 Hummel's Wharf. Thanks to everybody that subscribed to our podcast. Go to iTunes, Apple Podcast app, or Google Play. Search Steve Jones Show. Hit subscribe. Put the shows right in your smartphone and tablet. So if you're on vacation, like Steve, you want to catch up, you can do it the podcast way, or just go to our website, stevejonesshow.com. We got 3+ months of archived shows on the podcast archive page. So we're off tomorrow because of Phillies baseball. They got a day game tomorrow as they wrap up the series with the Dodgers. So we'll have another best of on Friday. We'll go Penn State football heavy on Friday with former Nittany Lions offensive lineman and current Tampa Bay Buccaneer Donovan Smith. We'll also hear from Mark Brennan from fightonstate.com. And also, we'll have James Franklin on the show. We'll go back to either the National Letter of Intent Day interview in February, or if we're able to, get some fresh audio from Big Ten Football Media Days in Chicago. Coach Franklin's scheduled to speak on Friday morning. So we'll either have February audio or some new stuff from Friday morning from Chicago for you to finish out our best of week. One of the new analysts on the Phillies radio network is Kevin Fransden. He made his first appearance on the show in late March, right after the season got started.
Let's get to the Phillies. I want to talk about lineup balance.
Okay.
There's a certain way now. Obviously, analytics enters into some of this, but there's also traditional lineup balance. Do you like the lineup balance of the Phillies initially?
Absolutely. And you can say what you want because of the success yesterday. But I think you would ask most sabermetric inclined front offices, analytically inclined front offices, they would love to have the same lineup as much as possible. They would love that. They would love to have five starters be able to go 200 innings and feel like they're going to be better than anyone that they have, whether it's in the pen. You know what I'm saying? Like, so when it comes to this team and seeing where Michael's hitting eighth. And with Odubel and Herrera in the 6-7 spot, and you can flip-flop them however which way you want, the depth in the lineup, there is no breath for the pitcher. Is it one that is going to be like, you know, we're going to hit 20 homers during the week? Maybe. Absolutely it could.
But it's also it's a lineup that has the ability to put the ball in play. It has the ability to go first and third, score on a double in the gap standing up. The biggest thing for me, can this team score on a double in the gap standing up? I would say 7 of the 8 guys, maybe. I mean, because once Reese goes, Reese can run. I mean, Franco might be the only one for me that is the one that might have to slide at home. But I'm just saying, like, their athleticism, the depth that they have, the ability to maneuver guys in the lineup if they need to, right? If they need to move, you know, Cesar up to leadoff spot and bring Kutch back into a run driving role, they could do that. And it's not just saying this after one game. It's watching it throughout the entire, Cactus League, the Grapefruit League. And for me, when they had the lineup together, they protected each other. And that's a huge thing. The year that Bryce Harper has, in my mind, is all coordinated with how good is Reese and how good is JT, the guys behind him, right? I mean, if Reese is making them pay every time, it's not going to happen every time, but if he's making them pay more times than not, Bryce's going to start seeing a lot of pitches to hit. They're not going to be, you know, pitching around him. And the same thing goes for Reese. If they feel like, oh, we got to pitch around Reese, well, okay, you got JT Realmuto behind you, who is, you know, in my mind, maybe a top 2-3 hitter in that lineup as far as just overall, like power, just hitting ability, and then you take into account his wheels, and I think that you have a top 3 guy with him.
It's interesting, JT Realmuto, who is, I thought, an incredible acquisition, but it gets overshadowed by Harper, and I understand that. But look, you know the value of a guy in that spot. And you know the value of a guy that can hit out of that spot because of Buster Posey. I mean, what does JT bring to the table? And are there any qualities that you see in him when you've watched him that you that remind you of Buster Posey in any way?
Absolutely. And knowing Buster for so long, you know, being here in the Bay Area with him and playing with him and knowing his personality, just talking to JT, they're similar. Very analytical in their mind, they have a good time, but they're very serious about their job, and their job is to do everything possible to win a game. And when it goes to that, when it comes to hitting, it's the line to line that he has, that Buster has. Maybe not as much the bat control as far as two strikes, you know, per se. But like, there's not a lot of guys that do that Buster has. But the thing that just tops Buster is he has the ability to run. He can beat out chopper in the hole, the sixth hole, in August, right? We're not talking about, like, April. April, JT, absolutely. Most catchers get, even I'm a Yadier, we can't put Yadier in there. But most catchers in April have a chance to beat something out there, right? I mean, in April. But you go to August, they start to slow down and do all that. What JT is able to do, and watching him over the years, he sustains that speed. Maybe not top notch, but like you can't really. Where do you go from? You go from, I don't know. You're going from a Ferrari to a souped up Tesla, I guess you could say later on, right? I mean, I don't know. Like it's not really a bad thing to go with there with JT and his legs. So with him in regards to offensively, I think there's a lot of similarities. Be able to go opposite field, stay up the middle, you know, two outs, runners in scoring position, I think is huge with JT. He's a guy that, you know, doesn't concede the innings over. And I think that's a lot with Buster. Buster's a guy that, you know, over the years has shown that. With that being said, I still don't think JT's hit his peak yet. That's the scariest thing. We haven't seen the best as far as when he was with the Marlins, because I think you're in a situation where yesterday's crowd, if that's going to be the consistency at the ballpark this year, oh my gosh. For a guy that played in front of 9,000 fans every game, like, can you imagine that? Can you imagine the uplift? Can you imagine, like, I feel tired going to the... You never feel tired. You never do. Not with the energy that they had yesterday. And so I see so many positives with JT. Like you said, it's going to be overshadowed by the Bryce thing, but I think that could ultimately be the most important signing of the year, or trade of the year, acquisition of the year, because of the position that he plays and because of how good he really is at that position that he plays.
Yeah, in fact, I think the Phillies will probably surpass the total Marlin attendance from last year by the end of May. And that's not a joke. I'm not kidding around. It's probably going to be like that. The end of May, they'll probably surpass that. How awesome is that?
That's so great. And if you're and you're like, for Philly fans or baseball fans in general, you should love when a guy like JT Realmuto goes from a downtrodden organization where their fan base sucks. Let's be honest here. It sucks. Right. And he doesn't really know the true love, right? A true fan base love. And, you know, guys are going to always say, oh, I don't play, you know, just so I get recognized and all that. No. But being adored and being just absolutely revered in your city, that's a huge deal. Any athlete will try to, like, downplay that. I'm sorry. Someone recognizes you down the street and, like, just, I'm a huge fan, and they do that consistently like they do in Philly. Oh, man.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about
it. Means a lot. What does it mean in the clubhouse that Bryce Harper's been to the playoffs, and actually I think when he's been in the playoffs, I think he's actually performed for the most part pretty well. Jake Arrieta obviously has been to the mountain. David Robertson has been on successful Yankee teams. What does that mean to a clubhouse, in your opinion, as someone who's lived in a clubhouse?
I think it means a lot because you know that I think guys that have been consistently to the playoffs, yeah, they think about it, but they are the ones that stay in the moment the best, right? They're the ones that are able to go day in, day out and perform at their highest level because they know if they do, it gets them that much closer to the playoffs. And if you are a mainstay in something like a Jake, for instance, with Jake Arrieta being, you know, the ace 1-2 of the staff in Chicago, every fifth day, it wasn't like, you know, in May, he was like, can't wait till October on this whole thing. No, he was so into the moment, and I think that's the biggest thing. Because if this team, as we saw last year, this team gets into August and they have a lead or they're in first or they're a couple games out, whatever it is, and they're chasing, what are they chasing? Are they chasing the playoffs or are they chasing that game in front of them? And I think those two, especially Bryce and Jake, they're able to know more than anything. You have to chase that game in front of you, that game that's right there that day, because if you do – and you get it, you roll around with it, boom, you beat it, so you know you're closer to the promised land of where you want to go, and that's the playoffs, where it's a crapshoot for everyone. And I think having those two in there, and then you add in, like you said, David Robertson, I think is even bigger. But then I think more than anything, guys like Gene Segura, guys that have not been really in that and have had success in the big leagues, they're hungry for it. And I think that is a huge thing that we might overlook. And the same thing goes with Andrew McCutchen. I think he's got to experience a little bit of the playoffs.
Yeah.
That's it. He wants the bling. He wants the ring. And, you know, McCutchen, to me, is that guy that I could see coming in here and having that hunger that guys feed off of, you know, but it's never talked about from him. But guys know that he's hungry to get something going in the next couple of years of his contract here in Philadelphia.
No question about that. It's also a grind, and the Phillies found out firsthand once August began last year what kind of grind it really is.
Yeah.
So if you're a younger player, and I go up to Kevin Franzen and I say, hey, look, you've lived this grind before. You know, how do you handle the grind of 162? So what would your advice to them be?
Honestly? Oh, man. You're playing baseball. There's no grind. I mean, that's I'm very rare on that whole thing because I don't see it as a grind. What's grind, you know, grindy is digging ditches and stuff and working till, you know, wee hours of the morning, you know, for all intents and purposes. Like, I just don't see baseball as being a grind. Physically at times, yeah, it's a grind, but at the same time, you're going like, what else would you rather be doing? Like, you wake up in the morning, and if you are, for a young guy, if you're feeling sore and tired, like, get over it. You're in the big leagues. You're in a playoff chase. You're in a situation where everyone dreams of. And, you know, it took me until, I think, my year, year 32 of my life to get into the playoffs. I've been dreaming about it, been like, you know, going into spring training thinking nonstop that this is the year, this is the year, this is the year. And I finally get it in one of my last years of playing, and I will never forget that feeling because I always had that feeling. It wasn't a grind. It was a grind only mentally when it came to, like, it's on the cusp, you know what I mean? Like, you're right there. You're like, oh, man, this is – that might have been the mental grind. It's like, I just want to get this done. I want to get in the playoffs. I want to experience this. But for a young guy, man, you're playing it's easy to say. It's cliche to say. It's all that. It's a kid's game. It is. I don't care if it's a kid's game. It's a grown man's game, too, and you should have so much fun doing it.
Totally agree with that perspective, because obviously I broadcast games for 35, 40 years. Believe me, there's no such thing as a grind to doing it. It's fun being at the ballpark or in the arena or in the stadium every single time, and you can tell the players feel the same way about what they're doing. I want to ask you about the transition to broadcasting, though, because obviously you and I are having a lot of fun talking back and forth here, and it's a really easy thing for you to do. So what's been the easiest part of the transition to the broadcast part, and what's also been the transition you didn't expect?
The easiest thing in the world, and I tell this to everyone, is being a color analyst hard? I say no. I say yes when it comes to describing things, you know, perfectly or giving that, you know, the right picture. That's hard. But I did a sports talk show here in the Bay Area for a couple of years, and I mean, it was fun. I love sports more than anything, but it kind of, you know, it kind of wears on you a little bit here and there. The best thing in the world is opening the window and watching the game, like you're talking about the game. I always feel like I'm just,
you got that right. You got that right.
I'm going, are you kidding me? Like, I'm not stuck in a studio. I am out here. I get to smell, whether it's good or bad, I get to smell the stadium smells. I get to hear everything. I get to hear people complaining about the umpires or the coaches' decisions. It just became like an easy transition because I love baseball. I am more passionate about baseball than anything. And the Phillies organization, whether people think it's, I'm playing something on this one. I love the Phillies organization. I was in it for 3 years. Whether it was in the minor leagues or the big leagues, doesn't matter. It was 3 years, three plus years, including the next spring training at 14. The family that they created, David Montgomery being number one in this whole thing, it makes it easy to want to go to the yard, go to the play, and do all that stuff because it is the best. It is so much fun. Now, the hardest thing, I'm definitely not a loose cannon. There's two things that I find hard. Number one is filling in for L.A. Because L.A. to me, I'm very lucky here. And basically my mentors were Dwayne Kuiper and Mike Kruko with the San Francisco Giants. And they were guys,
Can't ask for better.
And they taught me so much. And then I get to Larry and Scott when I was playing there, and they were nothing but good to me. And I talk to them all the time, and I love L.A. It's so like having to, you know, go on for him when he's away, it's tough. It's tough because people love L.A. I love L.A. Like, do I want to hear me or L.A.? I want to hear L.A., right? I mean, that is the truth. I love the job. Trust me, I love the job. But it's the fact that, like, there's something about him and Scott, the genuine friendship that they have. It's hard to say that it's easy to walk in there. Now, Scott Fransky makes everything easy. He makes my life easy. He is a friend of mine. The friendship will always continue to keep growing, and hopefully it will keep growing for many, many years. So that's like it kind of backs off that and makes it easy. So another hard part, and sorry, long-winded on this, was they challenged me to do some play-by-play during the spring training and doing, taping and just doing it, not live or anything. And the speed of the game and how crazy fast it was as a play-by-play guy on the radio. Holy hell. That game moved so fast, and there were so many times I caught myself going, slow down, slow down, slow down. I already had respect for play-by-play guys. I already did. And that didn't need to be seconded, you know, by doing it. It was just afterwards you just go, man, how do you do that all the time? And there was a play like against the Blue Jays, and luckily this was on tape. So Segura makes an error, runner at second, Kevin Pillar was rounding third with two outs, and the next thing you know, Segura goes and picks it up and fires the third. He gets in a rundown with the guy at third. Now the rundown goes at first, and I was just doing a taping on this. I went, oh man, and I just shut down because the game moved so fast at that point for me. I had no idea what to do. And so, you know, Scott listened to it. Rob Brooks listened to it. They just told me, back it off, try to go as simple as possible. And so I just kept on going every day to do the play-by-play just to make sure that if I have to do a couple innings here and there, if Scott Scott needs to go somewhere for a second, I could do it. And I got two live innings during spring training. It was so much fun.
Well, it was a lot of fun having you on today. I really appreciate it a lot. You do a terrific job when you're on, and we appreciate the time you gave us today.
Well, I thank you for that, and I think it's next year my San Jose State Spartans go to Happy Valley, so I'm making my way to my first Penn State football game.
Well, we're looking forward to having you here.
All right. Can't wait.
Yeah, look up Jack Hamm and me before the game. We're more than happy to talk with you for a while.
That would be awesome. Meet you. Thank you so much.
You bet. Hey, Kev, thanks so much.
All right. You guys have a good one.